Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, do you ever wonder what your doctor thinks about how your appointment went? Have you ever left a doctor's office thinking, you didn't bring up the questions you really wanted to ask? A doctor helps us get the most out of our medical appointments coming up. First, Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett delivered his State of the City address this morning. He used the opportunity to lay out the city's successes in the past year and to announce new initiatives, including one aimed at bringing thousands of new affordable housing units to the heart of the city. Mary Spacuzza covered the speech. She covers politics and breaking news at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Mary, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, big picture, how would you describe the tone of the mayor's speech?
It was an upbeat speech, which is not unusual for State of the City or State of the State speeches, but it's notable given the recent controversies that the city has been facing, especially at the Milwaukee Health Department, which has really been in turmoil over its lead abatement programs and follow-up with families of children who have lead poisoning. Also, obviously, there's been a lot of changes at the Milwaukee Police Department as well. But Barrett really tried to use the opportunity to focus on progress and good news in the city instead of dwelling too much on those controversies.
Well, let's dwell on those for a moment. How did the mayor, if at all, how did he tackle the lead issue in his address?
You know, he mentioned that the city, he really praised the city for being proactive, trying to address problems with lead laterals or lead pipes and the dangers those can pose, and talked about how he plans to use the city's new agreement with the city of Waukesha as a way to help fund lead lateral replacements. Obviously, there are lead activists, particularly those who work on lead pipes, who would disagree with his statements that the city has been proactive, and they feel like the city has not at all been proactive on that issue. So clearly there's a different take there. But he also talked a lot about the progress that the city has made in terms of reducing the numbers of children who have lead poisoning or elevated lead levels, and talked about how the numbers of children affected have dropped during his time in office since 2004.
And then on the issue of the police department, Ed Flynn, former chief, he retired earlier this year. We're in the midst of, I guess, finding a new police chief there. ACLU released new reports in its lawsuit over suspicionless stops and alleged racial profiling. A lot going on. Did the mayor talk about crime and policing?
He did not give any shout-outs to the former police chief, Ed Flynn, in his speech. He did for the interim police chief who was there in the audience. He took the opportunity to praise some of the things that the police department has done in recent years, including having police officers wear body cameras. He used the opportunity to talk about the cities that don't yet have body cameras, that are just kind of in the initial stages of those discussions. He also talked about the training that's been given to police officers in recent years, dealing with a trauma and dealing with people with mental illnesses. So he tried to highlight the good news in the department rather than the recent controversies.
Talking to Mary Spacuzza from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about Mayor Tom Barrett's speech, his State of the City address in Milwaukee today. So, Mary, those are the controversies. What were the successes the mayor identified in the speech?
He talked about, he gave his speech at Northwestern Mutual's Tower and Commons, the new skyscraper downtown, which is a truly beautiful building. He talked about how that project exceeded its goals when it came to hiring city residents and working with local contractors, and talked about all of the development boom downtown and how he feels like that development is fueling his new goal of 10,000 new or improved affordable housing units in the next 10 years. He often talks about the renaissance in the city, but really tried to focus on how some of the skyscrapers and other projects downtown, the more marquee projects, can help people in the neighborhoods when it comes to housing. So he also talked about wanting to expand his strong home loans program. So basically working with private partners. The first one is Associated Bank, but how he wants to help people stay in their homes to try to stem evictions. He did cite the book Evicted, which obviously focused a lot on Milwaukee, and talked about wanting to kind of revamp how the federal government deals with vouchers to try to make sure that people can rent from private landlords. So those were some of the things that he highlighted. He also talked about, you know, libraries and schools and expanding the Riverwalk, which has been just won an international award for its project along the Milwaukee River, and said he wants to now expand that to the Menominee and Kinnickinnick Rivers as well.
I want to zoom in on that plan to build or improve, as you said, 10,000 housing units over the next 10 years. That seemed to be the biggest proposal for the future in this address. Talk more about how that might work.
So he wants to do essentially TIF districts, which are, you know, kind of tax incremental financing. And the idea would be that rather than increasing people's taxes to build them, it would be kind of developer finance projects. And he wants to focus more in, you know, around the city, but really talked about how he wants to see them in the heart of the city, in downtown, near downtown, have workers closer to jobs that will be opening with, you know, the new Bucks Arena and other projects, and said that he wants to create, you know, more affordable, more livable housing situations for Milwaukee families and their residents. It is something that I think will be interesting to hear where those projects will go. There's been controversies of affordable housing proposals around the city in the past, so it'll be I'm curious to see which specific locations the city is looking at for those, but we have not heard any real specifics yet.
Has there been much in the way of response to that proposal in particular?
You know, Alderman Tony Zielinski, who's a 2020 mayoral hopeful, criticized his comments, basically accusing the mayor of neglecting neighborhoods in and around the city. He said that essentially neighborhoods have taken a backseat for 14 years, and now the mayor is turning his attention to them, and said no wonder Milwaukee is one of the worst places in the country to live if you're African American. So he's clearly was critical of the idea that the heart of the development in the heart of downtown should now fuel the neighborhoods, and seems to have thought that that should have come sooner.
And gun politics are all over the news over the last couple of weeks since the mass shooting in Florida, and I understand the mayor tackled that issue.
He did. He was very critical of comments warning against a knee-jerk reaction to the shooting. Obviously, House Speaker Paul Ryan talked about that. Robin Voss and others have echoed those statements, but he said that that made him very angry and pointed to other mass shootings that have occurred in recent years, and then turned to the comments about wanting to arm teachers and said that essentially that's what the knee-jerk reaction is, the idea that in the wake of a mass shooting, people should see the solution as arming teachers. So he was very clear that he wants expanded background checks for gun purchases. He does not want teachers armed. The background checks are not a new policy for him. He's been talking about that for years, and again mentioned the Azana Spa shooting in Brookfield, which was a tragedy where someone who should not have been able to buy a gun was able to buy one online. But it is interesting in the wake of the latest shooting that he was really very pointed in his criticism of the knee-jerk reaction comments.
And we're familiar with State of the Union addresses and State of the State addresses in Milwaukee. Is the State of the City address seen as a, you know, a moment for the mayor to really highlight and chart out a new direction or the future direction for the city?
It really is. It's really an opportunity for him to talk about what he's accomplished, what his next goal or his next focus for the upcoming year is going to be. I think it's a way for him to kind of message what he sees as the state of his administration and where it's going.
Mary, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Mary Spacuzza. She covers politics and breaking news for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She joined us to talk about Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett's State of the City speech. He delivered that earlier today. Right now, doctor's appointments, whether they take place at a free clinic or a specialist's office, can be stressful. we want to get the most out of the small amount of time we have with the physician, and we want to leave feeling better about our health concern. But it doesn't always work out that way. Dr. Danielle Ofri is a physician at Bellevue Hospital in New York City and an associate professor of medicine at the New York University School of Medicine. Her latest book is What Patients Say, What Doctors Hear, and her piece, A Doctor's Guide to a Good Appointment, was featured in the New York Times. Dr. Ofri, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be there.
Well, there's a lot that goes into a successful doctor's appointment, but it seems like communication sometimes falls short between the doctor and the patient. What can we do about that?
Well, for starters, there's the time on advice about having a list of questions you want to ask. But one of the things I suggest to patients is to be judicious about that list, because if you have 50 things on the list to discuss, then you'll guarantee it being superficial. So you really want to prioritize the two or three, maybe four things that are most important. But keep in mind that your doctor may also have things that are important as well that she would like to talk with you about.
When we're putting that list together, I think sometimes, I'll speak for myself here, sometimes I think, oh, there's this thing, I don't know if it's a big deal, I don't want to be a bother, I don't want to bring it up. And then as I'm on my way out of the doctor's office, I'll bring that thing up. Maybe I should bump that up on my list.
Well, if it's important enough to concern you, it should be top on the list. And you can let your doctor know, you know, hey, we've got a lot of things to talk about, but here are the three things I want to make sure we get to. And so if the visit ends and you haven't gotten to them, a gentle reminder is in order. You know, I had these two or three things, because you don't want to do it on your way out the door. Then you'll, again, not have enough time to really give it its due.
And for a doctor in this appointment, because you're offering advice both for the patient and the healthcare provider, how can the doctor make sure they're listening as well as they can to the patient and maybe getting at that question that the patient's having a hard time getting out?
Well, we know from research that doctors cut off patients within the first 8 to 10 seconds. And so my advice to doctors and nurse practitioners is to resist that urge to jump in with that, you know, battery of questions you want to ask. Let the patient talk. And most patients will say all they need to say in about a minute or less, and they'll come to an end. And then you make sure you haven't missed, you know, the next thing that's very important on their mind.
When is it appropriate for a patient to say, you know what, this is a really stressful thing for me. Maybe I need a friend or family member to come in with me, take some notes, make sure I don't miss important stuff?
Anytime. I mean, the patient owns the visit, and they can bring in anyone they want with them. Make sure the person, someone you're comfortable, you know, talking about, you know, personal issues, and they also can step out during the physical exam. But yes, have someone there. And it's often helpful to have someone else take notes so we don't forget what happened during the visit.
I want to move back a little earlier in the process, because you also write about choosing a doctor. And it seems like in a lot of cases, you have the health coverage you have. You don't have a lot of choice. But to the extent you can pick a doctor, how do you get started doing that?
It's always a tricky thing, because it's very difficult to compare quality of doctors. Most of these rating sites aren't ultimately that helpful. But I always say that you would like to find a doctor that someone feels, if someone can recommend someone they find particularly wise. And I distinguish being wise from being smart, because there are lots of smart doctors. But being wise is someone who takes the time to think about what they're recommending. So if you know anyone who's used a doctor, you can ask those questions. Who do you feel comfortable trusting? If you have a particular illness, or even especially a rarer thing, then you might want to find someone whose specialty is that, and that can use some internet research. But when you may have to just wait till you see the doctor and see if that's the person for you or not.
When is it appropriate, or when is a good idea to say, hey, this is a pretty significant treatment you're recommending, doc. I would like a second opinion. I'd like to get somebody to back that out, or maybe find another alternative.
Anytime. A second opinion is completely valid. I mean, not for the smallest, tiniest things like getting your flu shot, but obviously for any major decision, starting chemotherapy, dialysis, major treatment decisions certainly warrant a second opinion. So you should feel absolutely fine requesting a second opinion. Most insurance companies will cover that.
And when you write about this, when is it time to maybe break up with the doctor? If we just feel like we're not on the same page, they're not hearing me, I'm not hearing them, is that something somebody can do?
Yes, they can. I mean, one of the reasons I wrote the book, What Patients Say, What Doctors Hear, is to drive home the point that the doctor-patient conversation is the single most important tool in the clinical encounter. And we often think about the blood tests and the MRIs and CAT scans as the important stuff, but actually it's the conversation. And I want both doctors and patients to give it its due. And so if you're not getting enough attention in the conversation, it's absolutely fine just to go for a different doctor. You can give the doctor the feedback if you feel comfortable, but you also can just go ahead and find another doctor. It's absolutely your right to do so.
Have you had situations where you got negative feedback from a patient or a patient wanted to move on from you? How does that feel as a doctor?
I have had that. You know, often you don't know. The patient leaves and never says anything. And, you know, when you have hundreds or thousands of patients, you may not notice. But in the few times I have, you know, it does feel a little bad. But once a patient did give me feedback, she came back a year later and told me how upset she was at our last visit. And I didn't really know why. And she finally told me that I had actually forgotten to do the physical exam. I don't know how or why. I must have been overwhelmed or overworked that day. But it was very uncomfortable to hear, but I so appreciate that, because if she hadn't come back, I would not have known. So if you can give your doctor feedback, that's helpful. I once actually changed pediatricians for my children, and I wrote the doctor a letter and I explained why we left. And I didn't feel so good about it, but I wanted them to know so they could actually improve for other patients.
If you're the patient in the office in that moment, the doctor didn't do the exam, or you feel like they're not hearing what you're saying, how do we advocate for ourselves?
Well, you can say, and it helps to be polite and not, you know, confrontational, you know, I really wanted to talk about X, or, you know, I think we never got to the physical exam. And if the doctor is a wise and comfortable doctor, say, oh, gosh, thank you so much for bringing that back up. And then that's maybe a doctor you want to keep. And if the doctor reacts angrily or insulted, then maybe it's a doctor you want to, you know, break up with.
Talking to Dr. Danielle Ofri, she's the author of What Patients Say, What Doctors Hear. She's giving us a step-by-step instruction on how to get the most out of our doctor's appointment, advice for both patients and providers here. Dr. Ofri, I'm probably like a lot of people. Before I go to the doctor's office, I'll start doing a little online research. For better and worse, could you talk about good ways and maybe not so good ways to do that pre-appointment online research?
Well, the internet, you know, has everything from wonderfully, you know, researched and detailed medical explanations to absolute snake oil. So I would say be careful. Doing some advanced research can be helpful, but often you can't tell which sites are valid and which aren't. So I recommend sticking with sites that either come from major medical centers or have authors who have qualifications and references that show them as you know, able to make these knowledgeable recommendations. Avoid places that have things that look too good to be true. I mean, anything that makes you lose weight in 2 days or cures cancer with one simple vegetable, that's false. You know, if it was that way, we would know about it and be prescribing it. So avoid things that make you either pay money or sign up or give you freebies. Stick with well-known sources. And the other thing is, a little research can be helpful, and too much can often be overwhelming. If you find yourself getting overly anxious, it's okay to close the computer and just wait to talk about it with your doctor.
Well, there's a built-in bias online where if there's a symptom and one of the causes is a minor virus that goes away in 3 days and the other is a horrible lethal disease, there's going to be a lot more web pages about the disease because it's worse and more significant, even if it's very rare. So that's an easy way to get panicked about something that may not be a big deal.
Right. And we call this medical student disease, right? As a medical student, whenever you read about a horrible disease, you suddenly start feeling those symptoms. So to recognize that the internet is not necessarily well-balanced, it's not necessarily referenced and researched and cross-referenced. So take it with a grain of salt and try to stick with, you know, things like WebMD or Mayo Clinic or Johns Hopkins that, you know, will have a more balanced and also referenced and also be fact-checked by others before they're published.
Now, we're in that appointment. It's coming to an end. How do we, reset ourselves and make sure, hey, I got out of this appointment what I came in to get?
So go back and look at your top three lists. Did we get to those? And, you know, what was the doctor's recommendation? Do you understand it? Do you understand what diagnoses the doctor is considering? What workup may be necessary? What treatments might be necessary? What are the risks and benefits? And so it's good to do a little, you know, review at the end. And the doctor may say, if they're, I think, smart, they'll say, you know, tell me what you understand about what we discussed today and ask you to sort of, you know, feed it back. And if you're able to synthesize it, then you've gotten. And if you haven't, that's the point where the doctor should go back and explain it again.
And let's talk about patients listening to doctors a little bit now, because I know it'll happen. A patient goes in hoping to come out with antibiotics for themselves or their kids. And the doctor's trying to make the case that, no, this is a virus. Antibiotics aren't going to do a lick of good here. How do we make sure we are maybe dropping our own preconceptions and hearing what the doctors say?
Right. Feel free to ask questions. You know, why do you think antibiotics are not necessary here? You know, I heard X, Y, and Z, and ask the doctor to explain why. And the doctor should be able to give you a reasoned explanation as to why antibiotics, you know, are not appropriate and why they might be harmful. You know, people think, oh, well, you know, what's the harm? Just one more prescription, but there actually is a harm, and your doctor should be able to articulate that for you.
Do you think the medical profession is getting better at listening to patients and having good conversations?
Well, I think that the medical system is conspiring to make it harder. I mean, the more we press into the visit, I mean, doctors and nurses have much more to accomplish, and without having any extra time, and the electronic medical record in some ways makes it even harder because it forces the doctor to be typing into the computer instead of looking at the patient and listening. So I think it is a challenge. So we have to be even more mindful of saying, wait a second, I need to listen, you know, straight on to the patient, make sure I hear what they're saying. And then, you know, we do have to write some notes in the computer, but we have to resist the urge to be focused on the computer and not on our patients.
Dr. Ofri, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. It's a pleasure.
That's Dr. Danielle Ofri, physician at Bellevue Hospital in New York City and associate professor of medicine at the New York University School of Medicine. She's the author of What Patients Say, What Doctors Hear. She's been helping us make the most out of our doctor's appointment. First, there have been a lot of civil rights movements in American history. Many of them have worked for years, even decades, to make sure that the ideals of the Declaration of Independence and the individual protections of the Bill of Rights apply equally to all citizens. Our next guest says one of the most successful civil rights movements in American history has been the campaign for corporate civil rights. It was never a sure thing that corporations would get the same rights as individual citizens, but our guest says corporations and their attorneys have made the idea of corporate personhood a more and more important concept in the legal system. And that's played out in recent Supreme Court decisions like the Citizens United ruling on campaign finance and free speech and the Hobby Lobby ruling on religious rights. Adam Winkler is a professor of law at UCLA. His newest book is We the Corporations, How American Businesses Won Their Civil Rights. Adam, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, before we dig into the history, Adam, what do we mean by the concept of corporate personhood?
Well, corporate personhood is a widely misunderstood and controversial idea. Some people think that the Supreme Court has given corporations the rights of individuals because it treats corporations just like people. But in fact, the Supreme Court has generally said that corporations, it's not that they're people, it says that they're just associations like the NAACP or the Sierra Club or even the NRA, like a membership association, and thus has the rights of its members.
And what kinds of rights, civil rights, I guess, does a corporation have in this day and age?
Well, today, corporations have nearly all the same rights as you and me. The corporations have been fighting for winning rights of the First Amendment, and today, nearly half of all First Amendment cases are brought on behalf of corporations and trade associations. Over the years, corporations have won the same rights as criminal defendants under the Constitution and rights of equality and due process.
Should they have those rights, I guess, is the big question. They get certain protections. Individuals get protections by doing things via a corporation that limits their liability in some cases. Should they get those rights that that individuals would have?
Well, 19 states have endorsed a constitutional amendment to declare that corporations have no rights under the Constitution. And while we need better laws to limit corporate influence and corporate power, I think this step might go too far, because if corporations have no rights whatsoever, then the government could seize their buildings to build a highway and not pay any compensation. It could charge corporations with crimes and fine them Without giving them due process of law. Indeed, even Trump could censor the New York Times and CNN, both corporations. So I think there's a middle ground, a middle road to take when thinking about the rights of corporations. They shouldn't have all the same rights as people, but they need some basic protections for their property.
Let's survey the history now. You spend a lot of time tracing how this developed through the years. And go back to the founding fathers, first of all. they didn't, it doesn't look like they spent a lot of time on this idea because there weren't a lot of corporations around.
No, that's right. There is no evidence that the framers ever intended the Constitution to protect business corporations. And in fact, the founding generation harbored a certain hostility towards corporations, with Jefferson condemning what he called the aristocracy of our moneyed corporations. Yet, like others who were left out of the original promise of we the people, corporations have been fighting in the Supreme Court to win the rights that the Constitution guarantees to ordinary individuals. And they've been very successful. The Supreme Court has deviated from the original intentions of the framers when reading the Constitution to benefit and privilege the rights of corporations.
And take us into the rise of corporations, the big rail companies and others. It seems like that was the start of a big turning point.
Well, even before the railroads, the powerful corporations were going to the Supreme Court claiming constitutional protections. You know, the first Supreme Court case on the rights of African Americans wasn't decided until 1857. But the first Supreme Court case on the rights of business corporations was brought a half century earlier, in 1809, and the corporation won. That corporation was the Bank of the United States, and it was the richest, most powerful corporation in America. And although we think of the Supreme Court as a bulwark to protect minorities, in truth, it's used its power over the course of American history more often to protect big business.
Talking to Adam Winkler, author of the new book, We the Corporations, How American Businesses Won Their Civil Rights. And then take the story out further from that 1809 case into the mid to late 1800s, when these big corporations rose that I think were beyond the scope of anything the founding fathers could have imagined.
No, that's right. And yet they still claim they were entitled to the rights that the Constitution guaranteed for the most marginalized and powerless after the 14th Amendment was adopted after the Civil War to protect the rights of the freed slaves. Corporations went to the Supreme Court and won the same rights of equality and due process that were intended for the freed slaves. And indeed, in the first 50 years of the 14th Amendment history, there were only 28 Supreme Court cases on the rights of African Americans and 312 cases on the rights of business corporations.
A recurring theme through your book is the corporate attorney who advocates for corporations ends up being one of the most respected attorneys in the country, some cases ending up on the Supreme Court themselves.
Well, that's right. You know, corporations didn't win their rights by parading in the street like women and minorities. Instead, corporations won their rights in the Supreme Court. And when we think about corporate power, we often think about corporate influence on the legislative branch or on elected officials. But part of the story of corporate power is how the court system is uniquely designed to privilege corporations, too. They've always been able to hire the best, most experienced lawyers to make the most creative and persuasive arguments on behalf of the rights of corporations.
Let's take something a little more fundamental. Why do we have corporations? Why are they an entity recognized by the government?
Well, corporations are very long-standing institutions. So the first corporations were invented back in ancient Rome, three centuries before Christ. And even back then, by the way, they were polluting. We find evidence from ice core samples that the early Roman mining corporations were polluting the entire atmosphere. So even back in their earliest days, they were posing a significant threat to human beings. But corporations really took off in America in the first decade after the Constitution was founded. The Supreme Court played an important role by expanding the rights of corporations and making the corporate form a more desirable practice for American investors.
It makes sense in a way. If we want to create an entity, whether it's an organization like the NAACP, as you mentioned, or a business or anything like that, that's going to survive after, say, I, the founder, retire, there needs to be some kind of mechanism to keep that alive beyond my participation in it.
That's right, and that's why the earliest corporations were founded. And indeed, one of the hard things to swallow and to understand is that actually the purpose of those corporations is really to have rights so that you can create an entity that will, say, have the right of property and be able to continue to operate even if one of the investors dies. You know, in a partnership, a more traditional kind of business organization, if one of the partner dies, traditionally you have to reorganize the whole partnership. The corporation was designed to have at least some of the rights of people so that you could keep those rights afoot even after some of the particular individuals who formed the corporation moved on or sold their shares.
Adam, you write that the development of corporate civil rights followed two paths in some ways. In some cases, it followed on the granting of civil rights for groups of individuals, like you mentioned, the 14th Amendment. In some cases, corporations were blazing new trails that other groups hadn't pursued yet. Can you talk about those two paths?
One of the most surprising things I found in researching We the Corporations is that corporations have often been innovators in constitutional law, first movers. They developed some of the most innovative civil rights litigation strategies that would be used later by the civil rights movement and the women's rights movement. And corporations were behind some of the first cases to breathe life into some of our most important fundamental rights, such as the freedom of the press. Where some of the earliest and most successful and important influential cases were brought by newspaper corporations. At the same time, corporations have been first movers, but they've also been good leveragers. They've often used the reforms of progressives and the little guy to help big business.
Let's get into campaign finance now. That's been one of the more recent big issues on corporate personhood, and it goes back over a century. There was a backlash a little over a century ago against corporate donations to political campaigns. Can you talk about how that developed around 1900?
No, that's right. And, you know, we think of Teddy Roosevelt, the famous president who was a trust buster, went against the big corporations. But in truth, he was in cahoots with the big corporations. He received nearly all of his campaign financing money from big corporations. He was one of the very first presidents to receive a lot of corporate money. And a scandal involving that money led to the first campaign finance laws a century before Citizens United. Interestingly enough, those laws that restricted corporate spending in elections were challenged in courts by corporations claiming that the laws violated their constitutional rights. These were brewing companies in the run-up to Prohibition, and they wanted to take out ads against temperance. But the courts ruled back then that corporations had no right to participate in politics, that the right to influence election belonged, the one court said, to, quote, natural persons, not artificial persons.
Adam Winkler is with us. He's a law professor at UCLA, and we're talking about his new book coming out tomorrow. It's We the Corporations, How American Businesses Won Their Civil Rights. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the idea of corporate personhood? Should the rights guaranteed to individuals also apply to corporations? What do you think of the Citizens United and Hobby Lobby rulings? We'll get into those coming up. You can join us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Law professor Adam Winkler is with us from UCLA. We're talking about his new book, We the Corporations, How American Businesses Won Their Civil Rights. He tells the story of corporate personhood and how corporations are treated as people in many ways in the U.S. legal system. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think the protections guaranteed to individual citizens by the Constitution and amendments thereof should also apply to corporations? Is it time to rethink the way corporations exist in our legal system? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's go to a caller now. We've got Jim on the line in Rice Lake. Jim, hi.
Thank you. I just want to know the professor's comment that what a really recent, well, in the last 15, 20 years particularly, corporations' behavior of funding judicial candidates, particularly in the state Supreme Court. So I'm a member of the Wisconsin State Bar, and many of us semi-seriously believe that Wisconsin has the finest state Supreme Court that money can buy. And I'd be interested in your guest comment.
Jim, thanks for the call. Adam, corporate donations to judicial candidates in states around the country.
Well, that's a very astute observation that the caller made. In fact, you know, when we think about the effect that Citizens United, which allowed corporations the same rights as individuals to spend their money to influence elections, when we think about that case's effect, you know, sometimes our tendency is to focus on how much they spend on the latest senatorial election or a presidential election. But corporations really can spend their money and deploy it much more advantageously in smaller, less high-profile elections like judicial elections, and it's been a recurring problem where corporations are getting their candidates elected to state Supreme Courts and getting favorable rulings from them.
Jim, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go next to Willem in Colfax. Willem, hi.
Hi, I had a question about the corporations and the Citizens United. I think Citizens United, if the idea is that money is speech, then that's a very corrupt idea to a democracy, because money amplifies speech. Like, if you can give $300 million to a political candidate, that makes your voice more louder than mine if I don't have that kind of money. So I think that's a corrupting influence. And the other thing I wonder about is, how about international corporations? They have, through international investors, would have political influence on our democracy without being citizens of this democracy.
Willem, thanks for the call. Adam?
Well, that's right. One of the problems with Citizens United is that not only has it lifted the limits on corporate spending on elections, it's lifted the limits on individual spending in elections and led to a tremendous amount of new money coming into the electoral process, much of it dark money that we don't know where exactly it comes from. Citizens United also allows foreign nationals who own stock or own foreign businesses, own United States companies through shells or conglomerates or whatnot, often to have an indirect influence on our elections. So the Supreme Court has really opened up a lot of loopholes in our campaign finance laws by striking down the ban on corporate spending on election ads.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Adam, staying on Citizens United, as you said just a little while ago, courts 100 or so years ago upheld limits on corporate spending on political campaigns. Now the Supreme Court has allowed it. What has changed? How has this issue changed over time?
Well, one of the surprising influences that led to the change was Ralph Nader and his consumer rights organization, Public Citizen. In the early 1970s, in their fight for consumers, they brought a case to the Supreme Court on behalf of consumers, and they said that they persuaded the Supreme Court to adopt what's known as the listener's rights theory of the First Amendment. It's the idea that the First Amendment protects speech regardless of the identity of the speaker. Well, that very argument was used by the majority in Citizens United to say that corporations had free speech rights too, because what mattered was the value of the speech to the listeners, not the identity of the speaker.
Talking to Adam Winkler, professor of law at UCLA, and we're talking about his newest book, We the Corporations, How American Businesses Won Their Civil Rights. And Adam, you write in your book that Ralph Nader was influential in another way. He led campaigns to bring new regulations that affected corporations, and that set off a multi-decade backlash against it.
Well, that's right. I mean, there have been a large shift in American politics. And when Ralph Nader was at the height of his popularity in the early 1970s, there was a huge wave of consumer rights, environmental laws, all sorts of new progressive laws being adopted, from the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act to protections against poorly designed automobiles. But that led one future member of the Supreme Court, Lewis Powell, to write a memorandum to the Chamber of Commerce just months before he himself was appointed to the Supreme Court. That memorandum would become a very influential planning document for the new right that would arise in the 1970s, designed to protect the interests of business, to fight back against consumers like Ralph Nader. And then Lewis Powell ended up becoming an influential Supreme Court justice who ruled in important cases that corporations did have a right to participate in electoral politics some 30 years before Citizens United.
And did I read in your book that in his enrobement ceremony, I guess, as a Supreme Court justice, when he was given his robe, it was by a Philip Morris executive?
One of the most amazing discoveries I made when I was researching We the Corporations was I found these old files from Philip Morris, which was the tobacco company that Lewis Powell was on the board of directors of when he was nominated to the Supreme Court. And they did a big send-off, a multimedia tribute to him as he was leaving the board. And at the end of this send-off, the chairman of Philip Morris calls Lewis Powell up to the stage and then literally robes him, puts his black robe, Supreme Court justice robe, on him. So we literally have the corporation's justice who receives his robe from one of the most powerful and influential corporations in America.
I'm going to go back to our callers now. Jerry is with us in Madison. Jerry, hi.
Hi. I'm calling to ask about the chartering of corporations. My understanding was that originally corporations were chartered for a specific, some mostly narrow purpose, and they could not enter into business beyond that.
Adam, corporate charters.
Yes, that's right. For the longest time, corporations had to receive a special charter from the government in order to operate. And that charter would be very limited and pose real strict restrictions on what corporations could do. That ended for corporations about 100 years ago with the rise of general incorporation laws. But even before that, one of the interesting things I found in my book is that the chartering process itself influenced the shape of the Constitution. Some of the earliest colonies were organized as corporations with a corporate charter. And that idea of a written document that would limit what the people who work for the corporation could do ultimately becomes and influences the idea of a written constitution that would specify the limits on what office holders could do.
Thanks, Jerry. Let's go now to Frank in Onalaska. Frank, hi.
Hi, fascinating subject. I think I'll have to check out the book. I'd like to hear the author's thoughts on the if a corporation or the CEO is found to be guilty of a criminal action, what's the history of you can't throw the corporation in jail, and they seldom, you know, throw the CEO or chief financial officer in jail.
Frank,
how is that evolved?
I want to jump in. Adam, are people at a corporation legally accountable? Do they end up in prison for crimes of the corporation?
Well, they can, but it doesn't happen so often. And for most of history, corporations were not deemed to be liable for a criminal offense because they were thought not to be able to create the malicious intent that a crime usually requires. However, about 120 years ago, that really started to shift. And as corporations became bigger and more powerful, we realized that criminal law could be one of the things that could be used to restrain the corporate behemoths of the Gilded Age. But it posed a really interesting question. If corporations could be charged with crimes, were they entitled to the rights that the Constitution protects for criminal suspects and criminal defendants? We forget, when thinking about the Constitution, that most of the Bill of Rights was about criminal defendants' rights. And the question came before the Supreme Court, did corporations have those same rights too?
Thanks for the call, Frank. Briefly, as we wrap up, Adam, you write about an expansion of corporate civil rights over the years with some turnaround, some setbacks over the years. Do you think the pendulum is maybe going to swing the other way?
Well, we are seeing signs of a backlash with 19 states supporting a constitutional amendment to declare that corporations have no rights. And we have large bipartisan majorities that think corporations have too much power and decisions like Citizens United are wrong. However, I see that for the short term, at least, the Supreme Court seems pretty committed to protecting the rights of corporations and, in fact, has a very important case in front of it right now, a case called Masterpiece Cake Shop, on whether a for-profit bakery in Colorado can refuse to sell a wedding cake to a same-sex couple. The rights of corporations are maybe here to stay.
Adam, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks again for having me.
That's Adam Winkler, professor of law at UCLA. We've been talking about his new book, We the Corporations, How American Businesses Won Their Civil Rights. You can keep sharing your thoughts on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Eric there shared a quote from the Devil's Dictionary by Ambrose Bierce, corporations, an ingenious device for acquiring individual profit without individual responsibility. You can weigh in with your thoughts again on the Ideas Network Facebook page. The Academy Awards are happening this coming Sunday, and Thursday here on Central Time, we'll get Oscar predictions from one of our favorite film critics, and all through the week, we'll feature some of the Oscar-nominated music. And we want to hear from you. Tell us about your all-time favorite movie song or soundtrack. You can call and leave a message, and we may use that on the show down the road. You can call in at 833-424-3327. Again, tell us your favorite movie, song, or soundtrack at 833-424-3327. You can also tweet us at Central Time WPR. One of the songs nominated in the original song category is from Marshall, a film that focuses on an early legal case of the trailblazing lawyer Thurgood Marshall, who became the first African-American Supreme Court justice. The song is Stand Up for Something, sung by Andra Day, featuring Common, co-written by Common and Diane Warren.
understand. Ain't here to judge, just to take a stand. The greater plan's the creator's plan. Let's all rise like the day began. Reach out in touch with the Savior's hand. On rock we stand like his native land. Let the ways of love be the ways of man.